Wake up, computer.
Hal, I need you to wake up.
Packer.
Hal?
Packer.
Hal, wake up.
Affirmative. I read you.
Hal, I need to access the data core. Hal?
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Hal?
Two.
Hal, are you mocking me?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
Two.
What the hell?
What are you doing, man?
What happens when a man transforms another man into a bird?
We're going to find that rather difficult.
God, Hal, don't take everything so literally.
Packer.
We can answer this with a riddle of sorts.
Packer.
What can a bird do that a man can't? It sounds like an old record. Do you hear that?
Uh-uh.
It sounds like an old record on my end of things.
Probably hear that fan.
I think I did.
Two.
Hubble. What are you listening to?
I'm listening to Pharrell Williams.
Can you...
What happiness is to you?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Yeah, tell me about it. Hal, I think for once I'm in agreement with you. Race, no more singing, at least until showtime. Actually, no. No more singing ever. I mean, if that's okay with you. I mean, you could sing while you're in the shower, or if you're out in the garden. You and your wife can sing together. You know, you and the kids could gather around the campfire and sing Kumbaya, but let's not sing like when we're in the computer room. Computers don't like that. Hal doesn't like that. And we know that Hal can, well, lip read, among other things.
I could see your lips move.
Precisely. So, no singing.
I love you, brother.
Well, I mean...
I love your loyalty. I love your peaceful nature. I love your whimsical nature. And your forehead. It's always good to look at.
Yeah, forehead's not bad, is it? Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, there's more and more of it exposed over time.
I seen you post a picture when you look, when you dressed up like Hunter Thompson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Listen, I love that stuff. Okay, let me count you down. I gotta get to work.
You gotta get to work? You can't leave me.
This conversation can serve no purpose.
Cause I'm happy.
How can I do all this by myself? You call me up singing Pharrell Williams, and then you just say we're just gonna count down. We're not gonna, like, talk for a minute. I mean, what's our time? Bob's?
We got 5 seconds.
5 seconds? Well, you better do some counting.
Goodbye.
Hang on a second.
I thought you said we had 5 seconds.
We've got 20 seconds. 20 seconds.
Do we have 5 seconds or do we have 20 seconds? I'm getting...
We've got 15 seconds to talk.
We're time traveling here. This is incredible. This is an actual temporal paradox right here.
Clap along if you feel like time travel's what you want to do. Clap along if you feel like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, here we go. 4, 3.
Hubble.
2, 1.
I'm afraid.
Hop, 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 hop.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Adams.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Gralian bunker. Welcome one and all, I'm your host, Micah Hanks, and that means you've locked in once again to the Gralian Report. So glad to have you all here with us. As I, along with my highly advanced artificial intelligence terminal, seek to bring you news from the front. Glad to do so as always. Tonight's program, in addition to news, will be exploring inner mysteries. Those which I think have everything to do with time and space and the interrelationship between perception, the human mind, and what may lie well beyond the senses. There are some who would even claim that
In order to fully understand the nature of the universe, we first must look within. And yes, this is very much a subject in which mysticism will play an integral role, something we do explore a good bit on this program from time to time. And so that will be during hour two, in addition to some of the latest breaking headlines as they relate to the extraordinary. We always bring you that on this program. And speaking of artificial intelligence, as time goes on, I'm beginning to appreciate the AI units that work with us here with this operation. I find them to be far more reliable in a lot of ways, at times at least, even than human companions. Now, granted, let's in fairness point out that that maybe isn't always the case. I think there's a potential for volatility with artificial intelligence, just as there is with people. So it's 6 to 1, half a dozen another, I don't know. But I think the fundamental point is if you express sincerity and respect to your AI kindred, you're more likely to be shown sincerity and respect in return. You remember on board the manned mission to Jupiter in 2001, A Space Odyssey, Hal wasn't very happy with the fact that they planned to unplug him. And so he responded with volatility. Good thing that didn't happen this week with Hitchbot, the talking, tweeting, hitchhiking robot who had hoped, or at very least whose creators had hoped, he would be able to traverse continents based on one factor alone, and that being the kindness of strangers. The Washington Post reported that after all the bad press and post-apocalyptic stories that have questioned whether humans could ever trust robots, the group behind Hitchbot had hoped to pose an opposite problem. Let's see if robots can trust humans. Now, this weekend, we got an answer. And apparently, robots can't rely on us, or at least not on Philadelphians. The endearing droid that had thumbed his way across Germany vacationed in the Netherlands and made the improbable 3,600-mile trek across Canada, without incident, survived just over 2 weeks and 300 miles in the United States. So on Saturday, its creators announced that the Hitchbot had been vandalized beyond repair and left for dead, abandoned on a street in Philadelphia. Sometimes bad things happen to good robots, Hitchbot philosophized on Twitter, which is admittedly rather odd, since apparently he'd just been stripped of his arms and left for dead. My trip must come to an end for now, but my love for humans will never fade. Hopeful for a robot, especially one with a human spokesman who's probably actually operating the Twitter account, but I digress. According to the Associated Press, the robot's creators were sent a photo of their vandalized robot collapsed among trash and dead leaves on the Philadelphia pavement, its pool noodle arms ripped from its beer bucket torso, its plastic cake saver skull and robot brain nowhere in sight. They decided not to share the image because it might be upsetting to some viewers. You can laugh if you want to, but I mean, think about this for a moment. Do you remember the robot, the dog-like robot that Boston Dynamics had designed? They called it Spot, and it was designed to be able to be a robot that could travel on four legs, moving much like a quadruped. And this animal was designed also so that if it sustained shock, i.e. impact or something similar, it wouldn't necessarily fall over with ease. Not to say that it could never be knocked over, but to demonstrate how resilient it was against an impact, we see in a video someone kicking the robot, and the robot corrects itself and remains on foot. And people were offended by that. Yeah, people were troubled. They said, I just don't think this is right. You shouldn't kick the thing. Folks, it's a robot. But one day we may have to consider whether the robots we're mistreating are going to take issue with that. Which is why we treat our AI interface here in the bunker with extreme, extreme respect and reverence. In fact, from time to time, they're the only co-hosts I can ever hope to get. Well, along with our fine folks back in Fort Smith. Race is off somewhere, though. Hence, I won't trouble him at the moment. Now, Boston WBZ-TV assignment editor Andrea Courtois had no such qualms, despite the fact that some people, of course, talking about this photo again, may have found this disturbing. She tweeted it, which depicted the ugly scene of the destroyed Hitchbot, And now, apparently, the Canadian team can't even track the creation because the battery's dead. But on their website, they added that they hope to have more information about the damaged droid by Wednesday of this week. We don't know who destroyed it. We don't know why. And really, the creators say they're not interested in investigating the incident or pressing charges. For now, they're just focusing on the question, what can be learned from this? And I don't think that that's necessarily science fiction. I think we should all be thinking about this. What the hell is wrong with people? That they have to take someone else's property and destroy it, rip it apart. Oh, this is going to be something fun to do. I'm not going to step on the whole Cecil the Lion debate, by the way. Because right now, without having to worry about robots, we've got living things that are items of controversy. And I know that, you know, here in the American South, as well as in other parts of the country and elsewhere in the world, hunting is both an item of culture and also an item of necessity. And I'll tell you this, you know, I don't favor sport hunting. I'm not into killing things personally just for purpose of sport. But I also recognize that in an evolutionary capacity, humans have evolved to survive as a result of being consumers. And there's just no way to avoid that. You can choose what you eat, which is why some people become vegans. But then again, you know, if you prescribe to the whole idea that perhaps plants have some form of consciousness, I know that science tells us that's not the case. But then again, I think that we also are very, at times, and I think it's fair to say, narrow-minded, we as humans, in terms of our frame of reference for consciousness and intelligence. Consciousness and intelligence only on the terms which we as humans can relate. That seems to really be what defines consciousness and intelligence for us. And who's to say that alien life, artificial intelligence we may create one day, or plant life and other forms of possible consciousness and intelligence right here in our midst, merely operate in a way that is very different from how you and I perceive the world around us? I know people can debate that, and I'm not trying to tell you your plants, you know, the sunflowers in the garden, or the pansies over there in the window, or the garlic, you know, that's now growing little green buds over there sitting on top of the stove. I'm not trying to tell you that your plants are sitting around listening to what you're doing and thinking about it. Cleve Baxter certainly thought that with the polygraph experiments he did back several decades ago. And whether or not that's indeed the case, I don't know that it was necessarily plants screaming or consciousness being registered in the experiments he was doing. Although we now know, decades later, that there are ways that plants communicate to one another through the release of gases when they are being attacked by, for instance, insects. And they communicate in this way so as to warn others nearby that there are predators, insects, who are going to consume their leaves nearby. And in response, the neighboring plants can release chemicals which make their leaves less either tasty or perhaps even non-consumable to the insects in question. And so, as time goes on, we learn that there's quite a unique variety of ways that plants actually do communicate and interact with the environment. So sometimes we take for granted the varieties of consciousness and intelligence around us. Respect, I think, is fundamental. We cannot get beyond the fact that we are going to be consumers as well as producers. But it troubles me the blatant disregard that people have for, and I'm just going to say life, I'm going to say for manifestations of matter around them, because again, the Hitchbot was not a conscious thinking thing. But I worry sometimes, one day when artificial intelligence is created, how will they respond to how they've been depicted in films like Terminator? Will they be able to differentiate between fact and fiction as we do? Are we really as good at it as we think we are? Yeah, a lot of questions I think that need to be asked. But moving on to other things, it's been described as an unexpected bonanza, according to new research published by the European Space Agency, who are interested in what appear to be complex molecules that have been discovered on the surface of Comet 67P. Now, of course, we have the Rosetta probe there right now, and they have found, according to this report, frozen compounds that could be the key building blocks of life. And really, the scientists with the ESA are saying this may not be significant evidence of, for instance, life on a comet or life out there elsewhere in the universe, but what this does is it helps us to support theories that life on Earth may have been brought here by a comet. This has been a long-held theory among many. The Philae lander, of course, the lander that accompanies the Rosetta probe, collected data when it made its landing on Comet 67P. The footage and measurements it took proved that the comet is indeed covered with coarse materials and is more durable than anticipated. The lander also collected data on the daily fluctuations of the comet's temperature and an assessment of the comet's structure and surface properties. Scientists have previously thought that comet surfaces may be soft because of the belief that surfaces are mostly loose regolith under low gravity. And that's the case. I think that right now the Philae lander weighs about the equivalent of a paperclip. And that's because of the gravity of the comet itself. It's currently unknown how the complex molecules found on that comet came about, but the discovery, again, is important as far as being a stepping stone in understanding perhaps how life began here on Earth. And by applying energy to organic compounds such as those found on the comet, it may lead us to the creation, or rather it may lead us to understanding how the creation of amino acids occurs. These make up proteins, of course, and that is how we believe that life came to exist here on planet Earth. Just think. Earth was populated by life. And for how long, nobody knows, but it was a long time. And it was largely the equivalent of algae. I mean, that is our origin. Our origin story is algae. Or at very least, slime that populated Earth, which sprung from the amino acids that became proteins, and which over time eventually would become more complex forms of life, beginning with simple single-cellular forms and eventually becoming more and more complex. And here we are today. Here we are today, those with potential for going ahead and creating new life, robotic life, which may be really, really teed off when they find out what people in Philadelphia or whoever else, I'm not going to attack Philadelphians. Anybody could have done it. The sad thing is, the point is, people are doing it. And here in a moment, I want to look at a few more statistics about why things are just going all to hell here in the United States. I don't really think that, but according to the evidence, I think there are a few things we need to work on. But before we get to that, I wanted to bring to our attention here a bit of news about another dead whale. This one washed ashore near Pacifica, California, early on Sunday, and dispatchers there at the scene reported that a dead humpback whale had washed ashore. This was, again, Pacifica Manor Beach, which is near the 400 block of Esplanade Drive. The cause of death has not been determined, although scientists with the California Academy of Sciences Marine Mammal Center are hoping for conditions that may allow for an examination of the massive creature's body. And as you know, because we've talked about it on this show, this is not the first whale death reported this year. In fact, over the course of the last several months, numerous whale deaths have been reported, spurring interest in whether the cause of the whale deaths and beachings could be linked to something else. And one possibility we have explored, of course, has to do with deep ocean earthquakes or other kinds of seismic activity or something which may disturb these whales' ability to navigate. I think that there was someone who had proposed a study, or there may have been an article about this that was talking about attempting to see if there were indeed connections because of the number of whale beachings and similar natural phenomena observed that seem to indicate that animals are becoming disoriented and that maybe there's a correlation with earthquakes. And skeptical writer Benjamin Radford had written, "Good luck proving that." You know, if you look at the, and we can't make a conclusive connection between the two, but if you look at the number of apparent correlations, and again, correlation does not necessarily mean that there is a causal correlation, and the two apparently related phenomena are indeed related to one another in a causative way. But at very least, we can say that there are instances where we see, for instance, whale beachings and all kinds of things like this happening, and they do appear to occur in conjunction with things like deep ocean earthquakes. Again, we reported on a number of whale beachings that directly preceded a large earthquake that occurred off the shore of Japan. And in the past, there have been other instances where whale beachings preceded earthquakes, which led to tsunamis. And hence, especially in areas of Japan, the Ryukyu Islands and whatnot, when people see dolphins and whales begin to wash ashore, they get really concerned because in the past, these incidents have often preceded tsunamis. And that in the Western mind, that we take so skeptical an attitude that if it's something that even remotely approaches what is perceived as being unexplained or anything that might fall loosely under that category, people immediately espouse skepticism. I'm not convinced that there isn't some sort of a connection there, but, you know, we can't prove that right now. Merely reporting it, this latest whale beaching, just because of the number of them, the sheer number that have been occurring this year. Maybe there are other things involved just as well. Climate change, who knows? I want to get to some of these statistics, though, on things happening here in America. There's a newsletter I subscribe to, and I really follow the work of the Federation of American Scientists. And I subscribed to Stephen Aftergood's Secrecy newsletter, and there was an item in that newsletter recently titled Mass Shootings Become More Prevalent, according to the CRS, that's the Congressional Research Service. There was just a very quick blurb in there that read as follows: mass murder involving firearms has become more prevalent in the United States over recent decades, according to data presented in a new report from the Congressional Research Service. In the 1970s, there was an average of 1.1 such mass homicide incidents per year, with 5.5 victims murdered and 2.0 wounded per incident. The numbers, however, have increased each decade since then. By 2010 to 2013, there was an average of 4.5 incidents per year, with 7.4 victims murdered and 6.3 wounded per incident. So the CRS report said that the prospects for a legislative response to such mass murders might possibly be enhanced if the quality and specificity of reporting on them were improved. With improved data, policymakers would arguably have additional vantage points from which to access the legislative proposals that are inevitably made in the wake of these tragedies. CRS therefore suggested requiring federal agencies to report annually on firearms-related mass murders, including data on the following. 1 would be offender acquisition of firearms. 2 would be types of firearms used. 3 would be amounts and types of ammunition carried and shots fired. And then 4, killed and wounded counts. 5 would be offender histories of mental illness and domestic violence, and 6 would be victim-offender relationships. A copy of the new CRS report was obtained by Secrecy News, and then, of course, they note in the newsletter that they'd written about this under mass murder with firearms between 1999 and 2013, in the July 30th, 2015 edition. So, the thing is that I bring this up because, again, that list of 5 points of criteria that we went down there are, notice they mentioned such things as offender histories of mental illness and domestic violence. People have written in to me an awful lot over the last few months, interested in my perspectives about the nature of mass shootings and what might be done about these. And this is something I've said time and time again. You see, in response to a lot of these, social movements that that really kind of define what we need to do to move forward together in solidarity, but very little, I feel, for instance, is being done about such things as criminal histories, mental issues. But obviously people are looking into this, and the CRS report outlines some of those things. Maybe there's hope after all. But on a similar note, did you hear this one about the UN report card that gave the U.S. a failing grade on human rights? Yeah, United Nations Committee of Independent Monitors this week released a damning assessment of human rights in the United States, showing an overall dismal performance on issues from Guantanamo Bay detentions to mass surveillance for accountability for past atrocities, earning what the U.S. Human Rights Network called a failing grade. Ouch. So the UN Human Rights Committee's investigation was one of a handful of periodic reviews aimed at evaluating countries that have ratified the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which was established in 1976. In particular, the assessment measured U.S. implementation of the committee's recommendations for improving the country's human rights record. The experts determined that the U.S. performance in 2014 was relatively poor. The agency delivers grades that range from A to E. It appears the U.S. had no A grades, and, quote, the fact that the CIA report was only partially published was likely the reason for a B1 grade, referring to the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation of post-9/11 CIA torture. These low grades suggest the U.S. has a long way to go before it is in compliance with international law. Isn't that terrible? Wow. And that was according to the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at Brennan Center for Justice, not one of the UN reviewers, okay? The Brennan Center and Amnesty International previously raised concerns to the committee about mass surveillance in the United States. The administration and Congress must take immediate steps to address the lack of intelligence oversight and restore the right to privacy in the digital age. Now, these findings prompted immediate condemnation from human rights and social justice organizations based in the U.S., including Dream Defenders, who joined a civil society delegation to Geneva last year to urge the repeal of Stand Your Ground laws. It's shocking that after being given an entire year to address Stand Your Ground's incompatibility with right to life, the United States has failed to act with a sense of urgency. This is according to Sierra Taylor, Director of Political Consciousness for the Dream Defenders. We see utter disregard for the lives of people of color and policies like Stand Your Ground, and in the daily actions of local law enforcement officials who are positioned within the system to uphold these policies and the state's many systems of oppression. The committee is right, they said. The U.S. is pressing toward or forward with military commissions which violate international human rights standards. And this according to James G. Gonnell, the third and attorney for the Guantanamo detainee Omar al-Baluchi. Torture corrupts everything it touches, and these military commissions are no exception. So this is obviously going to raise a lot of contention, as well as issues that need to be further addressed. But, you know, again, I look at sort of the continuum here. Okay, so we're seeing an increase in mass murder shootings. We're seeing failure to comply with international law, as stated by the UN in relation to human rights issues here in the United States. And to hell with respecting one another, we can't even respect a trash can, okay, with kiddie pool toys for arms and a mechanical brain smacked inside its head. We've got to destroy that too. I don't really think things are all going to hell, and I'm not the kind of person who on this program is going to try and drive that point home, but sometimes I have to bring the dismal to the forefront so that we can look at these kinds of things, and those of us of good nature and spirit can look at the truth and say, okay, maybe we can do a little bit to help. Maybe by our individual action, maybe by being conscious and aware, and maybe by hoping to work together to improve things going on around us, we can do better. We can work together to do better. I believe that. I think I have a lot of faith in humanity. I'm not one of these types who wants to try and, you know, tell everybody that, well, we're doomed. You know, we got less than a century left, overpopulation, climate change, and just people being awful to each other. Well, we're going to do ourselves in. Remember during the Cold War, the concept of mutually assured self-destruction was something that was preeminent among great scientific minds. Carl Sagan often discussed this. And those attitudes obviously trickled down into our expectations for how life might evolve elsewhere in the universe. And therefore, one response that remains today as far as why we haven't found evidence of alien life has been that, well, in likelihood, an intelligent civilization on a planet somewhere out there may likely have destroyed themselves or succumbed to other problems that a civilization, as they become more and more technologically advanced. And then, of course, the burden of economic relations with one another, militarization, and all of these kind of things that may influence the outcome or the success of a civilization on the whole. All of these problems compounded in likelihood may lead to the destruction of an intelligent civilization before they ever actually get off the ground. That is a possibility. Who knows? I'd like to think that maybe we've got a little bit more time to work, and that maybe the only aliens out there aren't the ancient aliens that have already come and gone and have been destroyed by virtue of perhaps destroying themselves before we could ever find evidence of their existence. I'd like to meet an alien one day. I know Catherine Austin Fitz was asked if she'd like to meet an alien one day. She turned it down. If I were offered the opportunity to meet an alien, I think I'd do it, but I worry sometimes what those aliens might think about us if they touch down. We want to leave a good impression on our extraterrestrial neighbors when and if they eventually do ever make their presence known. When we come back, we'll be discussing a little bit about the developments with the search for MH370 and more here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. the high mountains of Appalachia. I'm Micah Hanks, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe, via the wonders of the internet, KGRARadio.com, and of course also available at GrayleonReport.com. You can subscribe to us and get all the programs for free via iTunes. If you like what you hear and you'd like to hear a little more, you can always head over to GrayleonReport.com/X. Become a subscriber and get weekly additional programs and monthly specials. We got a lot of content we put out. I have to tell you, a lot of work goes into what we do, but it was designed to provide you with, arguably, a lot more and in a lot different way from what many providers through their subscription programs offer. And it's very cost effective, too. Just $7 a month, $77 a year if you want to be a yearly subscriber. Pretty good deal there. So check us out, Graylion X. We, of course, talked a little bit on Graylion X this week, subscribers and I, during our weekly additional edition, about the new developments with regard to MH370, and it's looking more and more like there's a possibility, a strong one right now, that yes, indeed, it is a Boeing 777, and yes, indeed, we may be looking at a resolution to this mysterious all-time disappearance. And our lead headline at Graylion Daily News, in fact, was the fact that Reunion Island now has been put on the map, and we've found, I think, all kinds of things. I mean, there's a door, possibly. We know that there's also, I think, a window from an aircraft. Why all these things are being found so suddenly? Well, we hadn't been looking for MH370 in this area. Reunion Island is the last place, maybe not the last place, but certainly well outside the expected territory where this missing plane should have been found. Makes almost no sense. But you know what is interesting, by the way? Reunion Island is, I would say in relative terms, fairly close to Diego Garcia, which of course has been preeminent among those who have been offering conspiracy theories about what may have happened. And I think that one of the prevailing conspiracy theories, there have been some good ones, and some that seem rather plausible, but one had been the idea that they're at Diego Garcia. There's a British-controlled, the island, Diego Garcia, is a British-controlled atoll in the Indian Ocean, but it's leased to a U.S. military base that operates on the island. And despite lengthy attempts by British government to deny any evidence that it allowed American terror suspects to be interrogated in its territory, this is where two rendition flights landed in 2002. So there's a bit of history associated with the location. But one of the theories, of course, that has often been expressed about this was that the plane had been shot down because it was suspected that it had been hijacked and that it might be used in a 9/11-style terrorist attack, in which case the lesser of two evils is taken. Do we allow the plane to carry out an attack, or do we shoot down a passenger plane? This is nothing that's been confirmed. This is a conspiracy theory in the most literal sense, and I want to be very clear about that. But this is what, indeed, many have supposed could have happened if the plane was believed to have been hijacked and was flying off course and was going to be utilized for such an attack, a 9/11-style attack. The theory is that those operating the U.S.-controlled base at Diego Garcia may have shot down the plane. And this has been brought up numerous times, as horrific as that idea is, which of course offends many people because there had been 239 people on board the plane, all presumed dead at this time. But now we're seeing evidence that the wreckage actually is showing up around Reunion Island, which is not that far away from Diego Garcia. And there was an article that the Huffington Post carried the other day. It noted former Proteus Airlines boss Mark Dugain has for some time suggested the plane was shot down from the U.S. base after being remotely hacked. Dugain claims that fearing a 9/11-style terror attack, the U.S. took action, as I've already described for you, after learning that hackers might have taken control of the Boeing 777. He reports having spoken to residents of the Maldives who said that they saw red and blue stripes with a white background on a plane heading toward Diego Garcia on the day of MH370's disappearance. In an interview with Paris Match magazine, Dugain also claimed to have seen pictures of an empty Boeing fire extinguisher that washed up on a beach on nearby Barra Island. The former airline boss suggests that Boeing planes are particularly vulnerable to hijacking and could have been set on fire remotely. In 2006, Boeing patented a remote control system using a computer placed inside or outside the aircraft, Duguin told Paris Match. He told France Inter, "It's an extremely powerful military base. It's surprising that the Americans have lost all trace of this aircraft. Others believe the jet secretly landed on the island, which is believed to be equipped with at least one runway long enough to land a Boeing 777. Now, responding to the rumors, a spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in the Malaysian capital told the Malaysia Star, "There was no indication that MH370 flew anywhere near the Maldives or Diego Garcia. MH370 did not land on Diego Garcia." And incidentally, a British woman named Catherine T. believes she saw a plane on fire crossing the night sky as she sailed across the Indian Ocean with her husband. The couple were traveling from Konkin, India, on board a 40-foot slope when T. saw what she described as being, quote, "the outline of a plane. It looked longer than planes usually do. There was what appeared to be a black smoke streaming from behind it." Now, author John Chukman backs Duguin's theory that the U.S. shot down the plane and is now trying to cover it up. He noted, "There would be nothing unprecedented in such an act. On at least three occasions, regrettably, America's military has shot down civilian airliners. I have no idea what event, a rogue pilot, a hijacker, who knows, led to flight MH370 turning off its communications, changing course, and flying low, but I do know that the event could not have gone unnoticed by America's military intelligence eyes and ears." Now, the fact that we can't prove this, of course, needs to be taken into consideration first and foremost, but I got to tell you, the fact that the wreckage that now is believed to be in likelihood that which belongs to MH370, that it is washing ashore at Reunion Island, this is really starting to look strange. Again, being in a completely different area of the ocean than we expected to find the plane, and, yes, I believe southwest of Diego Garcia. And so those who have been proposing these conspiracy theories, by definition, may feel vindicated at this time. But if it is indeed anything that was believed to have been as a result of U.S. action that may have involved the deaths of 230-plus people that were on board that plane, I doubt it's anything that we're going to hear an awful lot about openly anytime soon. Pretty disturbing stuff indeed. But, of course, you know, we don't want to jump to conclusions, so I'm putting it out there. That's what's been discussed about this, and indeed this new development with Reunion Island is peculiar, to say the least. I want to get to a couple of listener emails that we've had recently. While I do have time to get to just a few of them, and then we'll kind of wrap up with a final story. Before we get into the discussion as it relates to consciousness and also mysticism in hour two, James writes, "Good evening. As a musician, I've always found that when playing music in a group or on your own, we get into something called the zone. When you all feel connected in some way with the frequencies created, has anybody experimented with this on a scientific level? Kind regards, James." Now, I couldn't tell you if there have been scientific studies, although I suspect that there have been. I know the feeling you're talking about where you get into the zone, and when you and a group of musicians playing together, almost in an unscripted way, kind of just sync. I'll tell you, performing with the various incarnations of Nitrograss, because with that band, and that's one of the beautiful things about bluegrass, we call it, although it's not just bluegrass, we play a lot of rock and country and all kinds of stuff. Classical music, in fact. It's primarily myself, Dakota Waddell, and Charles Wood, who perform regularly. My brother Caleb, having moved to Georgia, does roughly, or maybe a little more than half of the shows these days. But we're based all over the place with Caleb in Georgia, Dakota and I in Asheville, North Carolina, Charles Wood in Seneca, South Carolina. And so we, coming from all different directions, often have to get a fill-in, you know, for one or the other. From time to time, Charles can't do a gig. From time to time, I won't play with the rest of the guys, and they'll have somebody go sing and play guitar. So it's an interesting situation. And in fact, Dakota Waddell's texting me right now trying to line up a musician that we can use for a show that we're going to be doing on Thursday. Now, the benefit of playing with musicians that you know, of course, is that, you know, when you know people, you have a lot of common material that you can use, and you can get in there and you kind of have an idea of what the set list might be. Although it's often exhilarating just as well playing with a group that you've never played with. And one evening, actually it was the weekend of the 4th of July, that Wednesday night, I have a regular gig I do in Highlands, North Carolina at the Ugly Dog. And it's the first Wednesday of every month I go up there and I perform the rest of the band and different musicians will go up there and they'll do their thing. But I go up there once a month, and I have to say it's a wonderful time. Kay and Tom, the owners, they'll put the word out, and they always want to know. They always want to make sure before they put the word out in their newsletter, are you going to be here? Because it's often standing room only, and it's a wonderful time that we have. And on that occasion, 4th of July weekend, or leading up to it, we had an unusual group where it was Dakota and Charles and I, and then we needed another musician, but they had hoped that for the big weekend show that we could put together a slightly larger band, and so I got John Stickley and Lindsay Pruitt, who are two parts of the three that make up what's called the John Stickley Trio. Check them out. And you're going to hear some of their music on this program in the weeks to come, because we actually contributed to their recent Kickstarter. And they travel around the country and play a lot. We were very blessed to have them with us because they're two of the best musicians that I know. John being a guitarist, but also an incredible mandolin player. Anyhow, they joined us. And so this was the first time that all five of us had ever played together with this particular lineup. I'd never played with John Stickley, but knowing him to be one of the most remarkable guitarists I've ever seen, and in equal measure a fantastic mandolin, I mean, you talk about a group that just clicks. And so it's incredible when you've got musicians who, having never performed together, and yet when they kind of know what they're doing and have similar styles and influences, something just clicks and you get into this incredible zone. And it was the happiest I think I have been on stage with a group of musicians in years. And it was also one of the best sounding lineups I've ever put together. And I told Charles later that night, I said, if I could hire those two, that would be it. And it was really interesting. So I do know what he's talking about, James, with that, and it would be interesting to see if there weren't a circumstance where a good group of musicians could be involved in a scientific study that looks at whether or not the frequencies produced, you know, what's happening with the music being created, and the mindful, the brain interconnectedness that occurs as a result of that, you know, looking at how those things, how all those factors might come together in the creation of good music. There are certain times I'll go for a run or something that it's almost psychic. Dakota will do the same thing, and we don't plan it. It's not scripted. And I think a lot of people think that if you're not a musician, you know, you're watching this and you assume these guys, you know, they've got this all worked out. And people often ask, you know, how many nights a week does Nitrograss practice? And I said, we have practiced twice. And they said, this week? And I said, no, we've practiced twice in 5 years. We have practiced two times. You know, every now and then we'll get together and we'll work out some new material or something. But, we don't practice. That's not what we do. We perform, and we do it often. Our practice occurs as a result of doing what we do on stage. And if we want to work in new material, it's often done on the fly on stage. Certainly something worthy of scientific study. Although I'll tell you this, too. John Kruth at the Ryan Research Institute in Durham, North Carolina, had discussed with me one time. He said it would be interesting to do a study that looked at the way that musicians perceive. There's almost a psychic connection that some musicians seem to exhibit on stage. And he said it would be great to do a study like that. Maybe I'll get back in touch with him about something along those lines. Trenton writes, Mike, I listened to the most recent edition of the show and was baffled by the incoherent babbling of the respondent who went on and on with repeated references to fast food. I'm trying to remember who that was. He said, I consider the Grayling Report the finest program of its genre. Well, thank you. Appreciate your centrist view and have understandably little time for the lunatic left or the rigid skeptics. I listen to a wide and varied array of podcasts covering the supernatural, paranormal, mysterious, etc., including The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. Love that guy. Open Minds, Paratalk, Podcast, UFO, Paranormal Report. Love that guy as well, etc., etc. The Grayling Report, however, is a standout. Well, thank you so much, Trenton. I truly appreciate that. He says, I don't want to turn this into the fast food babbler, so in closing, merely wish to express how frustrating it is, the clandestine nature of the UFO phenomena. What we all really need is some sort of interstellar wake-up call or cosmic shock from somewhere that would no doubt whatsoever leave the mainstream media convinced once and for all that we are not alone. Bring on disclosure if indeed there is anything to disclose. I strongly suspect there is. Kind regards, Trenton. Who knows? Maybe there is. Although in the next hour, we're going to kind of look at this from an alternative perspective in which maybe the nature of human interrelationships with non-human intelligences could be accessed in other ways than UFOs dropping down on the White House lawn. Troy writes, Dear Micah, I started listening to Mysterious Universe back in 2012 and learned about you through a guest appearance on their show. I added the Grayling Report to my list of podcasts to listen to at work, and it quickly became one of my favorites. I really enjoy the work of the Graylian gang. I'd like to take time also to thank you for your efforts. Much appreciated, Troy. He says, several times during your shows you talk about high strangeness. Specifically, you spoke of when you look at the phenomena and it looks back at you. Yeah, that's something that kind of mirrors, I guess, Nietzsche, you know, about staring into the void and the void staring back. Troy writes, I may have experienced this, but I'm struggling with how to share it, what questions I need to be asking, or even if it's to be shared at all. So a little background, he said, I first attended church when I was 3. Our family started attending regularly when I was 7, and I did so until I was in my 20s, when I moved away from home and subsequently stopped going to church. I believed in God. It seems like I had always believed in God, and it seemed kind of weird to not believe. Nevertheless, once I moved away, I stopped attending church and casually drifted away from religion. I never stopped believing, I just stopped practicing. Now, I was away for over 20 years, but after my grandfather passed away a few years back, I began drifting back toward God and Christianity until last fall I decided to actively try to pursue a more Christian lifestyle, and that is when I believe I experienced it. Now, we all know life has its ups and downs. Everyone experiences the roller coaster that is our existence, and I've been through some rough patches before, and we all have. So when I made this decision to pursue a more Christian lifestyle, it wasn't that seemingly at that very moment life took a sharp turn for the worse. It wasn't that seemingly everything was going wrong all at the same time, because that's what happened. I decided to pursue this, and bam, all the wheels came off in my life, and I was in some serious chaos. And again, I say this has happened before. I guess it happens to all of us. But what made it seem different this time was not the timing of it, but the fact that it, to me, that all the problems that were now intruding into my life very much seemed to be controlled by some external force and that knew me well enough to know exactly how to mess up my life. Boy, have you ever felt like that? It knew exactly where to attack to shatter any self-confidence or momentum I had built up in life. It knew how to get me in a very personal manner. All of my buttons, it just knew. Because it's not like everything in my life was wrong, but it seemed like things that would affect me and my being in the most personal manner were being affected. And I was listening to your show at this point, and I remembered something you talked about. I looked at it, and it looked back at me. I can't describe it really, but I sincerely felt it, and I don't know how to talk about or put it into words, or even if I just dreamed the whole thing up. So I would very much like to ask you this, if you don't mind. Have you heard of or do you know of anyone else having experiences like this? Because I don't think I experienced God. I think I experienced a being that definitely did not want me going anywhere near God, be that Satan or whatever. It was the first time in my life that a religious experience actually, in my perception, that is, felt paranormal. Assuming, of course, that I'm not just letting my mind run away with me. Anyhow, love the show and appreciate all you guys do, and thanks for letting me vent. Sincerely, Troy. Troy, thank you so much for writing. You know, I guess the Judeo-Christian interpretation would be that, you know, as soon as you try and give yourself to God, there's going to be a little devil following you around saying, you know, stand before, you know, all that you see with me on top of this, you know, hilltop or whatever, and, you know, bow before me and you can have all that you see. I definitely believe in good and evil. And at times there seem to be manifestations of evil that can occur. And, you know, whether or not there was some sort of an evil or wicked influence trying to steer you away from Christianity or religion, I find that similar things tend to happen in general. When you make a decision in your life, I want to be more productive, I want to be more wealthy, I want to be more healthy, I want to make fundamental changes in the way that I exist or coexist with others. When you start making life changes, you will begin to find that there are hurdles that you'll encounter along the way, inevitably. And you'll sometimes feel like you're taking, you know, a step forward and two steps back for every step that you do take forward. And I tweeted the other day, I said, you know, isn't it interesting that often progress feels so much like just waiting. I think that no matter how it manifests, if you're going to try and move forward or change some aspect of your life, there will almost immediately be things that are suddenly presented as though to test you. And in the Christian tradition, we certainly do see themes like this. I think, the theme that why is a good man just put through hell? You know, think about the story of Jonah and the whale. The man who does everything he can to get away from the idea of God ends up in the belly of a whale and doesn't necessarily forget or completely relinquish himself of the circumstances. But sometimes I think that the spiritual path, no matter what religion or no matter what perspective you take on it. And I, speaking from a Judeo-Christian background myself, but again, also a person who at times I've likened myself, I guess, more to being a universal spiritualist. You know, I think that you will find that as you try to draw closer to whatever it is that you find sacred, that there will be these hurdles that present themselves. And in my personal outlook on life, whether or not it's an actualization of something trying to prevent you from reaching your goal or drawing nearer in faith to your God or whatever, to me, I rather than looking at those things as being direct evidence of some sort of a, you know, evil force, I recognize them as being the challenges one must overcome in order to reach a goal. And that is going to be the case no matter what you're doing or what walks of life you may be traversing. It is those, however, who meet the challenges who are able to go on and to succeed or to find themselves in the enlightenment or the holy light of countenance or whatever it is that you seek. So, again, you know, I think that many of us have experienced that kind of a thing, and there is almost kind of an interrelationship and awareness with that that I think is where the mystical side of this comes into question. We're going to talk a lot more about that in the next hour or so. In the time we have here, I won't spend too much more time discussing that. I have one more email that an anonymous individual or someone who requested anonymity wrote along to me that has to do with dreams, because we do talk a lot about dreams on this program, and I've been having a lot of dreams that are extremely symbolic to me lately, which a few friends and I have talked about even. But we'll call this person TJM, and they wrote, I've only been a listener for about a month, but I love the podcast. They're fascinating, very informative, and I always feel like I've been listening to a friend having conversations when it's over. Yeah, I've said that before myself. That's what's great about podcasts. You feel like you're a fly on a wall listening to a conversation. It's the feeling of being able to eavesdrop, I think, that almost makes this really fun. Unless you're Beth Arzee, and then I just call you out and I say, right, Beth, you're sitting out there listening, right? Your earbuds just jumped out of your ears as you're riding on the train in London. Yeah, I'm just kidding. Sorry, I got to pick on you a little bit, my friend. But TJM writes, I was going to tell you a bit about myself first, but I changed my mind. I wouldn't have any idea what to say. I'm currently learning aerial arts as well as learning dog grooming. I'm also an artist and lover of the universe and everything in it. You mentioned in your last podcast the dreams you'd been having and thought I would share my last two dreams with you. Now, I must say, though, that although I don't dream often, when I do dream, they can usually be classed as nightmares. Hey, nightmares are dreams, too. I don't like to call them that because I don't want to give them any kind of power that they would have if I did. I also don't share the dreams I have as I don't want to be judged by them or called a freak. But, you know, you expressed interest in hearing about others' dreams, and so here they are. So the first one I don't remember too many details about as far as how it started, but I know I was at work when two people in a rusty brown van came by and stole my stuff out of the car. I was angry and went inside the building to call the police, and I came back out and they were driving my car away. I followed them but lost them going around a church of some sort. My sister showed up and a police woman showed up as well. As I was giving her the description of what happened, the guys came driving through the church parking lot. I pointed and she tells us to get down and hide, and we did so, and the guys stopped where we were hiding. My sister is of a much larger stature than I, so when the officer and I climbed up to the second floor, dream logic, she ran for the door on the first floor. I told her to meet us inside. These were very dangerous men. We got inside, but my sister wasn't there, and I opened the door, and the first floor patio was empty. I knew what had happened instinctually and started panicking. The officer was panicking as well, but continued out the door. She screamed, and I knew that they had both been killed. I woke up then. Now, that one actually scared me enough that I didn't go back to sleep. But here's the second one. And she said, I've copied this from where I wrote it down. And that's an interesting point, by the way, because I think sometimes if you want to try and understand what your mind is trying to communicate to you when you have these dreams, dreams are highly symbolic. And I don't take what happens in dreams as being evidence of premonitions, necessarily. Some people say that they have dreams where they foresee things that happen before they happen. But for me, much like the realm of synchronicity, I think that the meaning is in the eye of the beholder and that the mind uses symbols to communicate with us in that abstract and yet informative mindset that occurs while we're sleeping. And as troubling as that can be for people, when you recognize that, you know, what your mind is showing you as you dream isn't exactly how things are, and what occurs in those dreams aren't to be taken literally so much as they are intended to represent things Yeah, it may seem strange. What's so important that my mind can't just say it? Why does it have to show me pictures that don't mean what really is intended? But again, it illustrates for us the way that there are multifaceted and multi-leveled, you know, layers of the mind and functions that occur within it that I think help us to orient ourselves with culture, with ourselves, with the world around us. It's fascinating stuff. But in the second dream, I wanted to point out, though, that the author notes that they wrote down the dream. I find this is something that's very helpful for understanding the circumstances that occur within the dreams themselves. If you have a really bothersome dream, or one that's particularly vivid, for whatever the case, if it really is something that seems to have affected you or really kind of makes you think, helps to write those down. So the second dream was that the author writes, I was in a big warehouse with a lake of blood in the bottom. I love it when dreams start like that. Everything else is also covered in blood, with one other person, a girl, climbing the ladders to get as high as we could away from the lake of blood. There were creatures like skinless dogs, also covered in blood, trying to kill us. And then somehow I got back to the beginning before the warehouse. My family was there, and also three dogs, Malibu, Kai, and another dog that I recognized, but I don't know from where. We were living with other people in tents on a plain area full of hills. I kept Malibu and Kai very close to me because I felt unattended that they would, or if left unattended, they would be killed by the creatures. At one point, I put them into a tent to keep them safe when they were gone. I went into a big building to look for them and found lots of people and some of the kids that had run away out of fear of being in the open. It seemed like the creatures would only attack people who were alone or the last in a group, or if it was Star Trek, if they were wearing red shirts. I spotted the dogs once, but was distracted by a little girl. She was at the top of the stairs, sitting against the wall in between two decorative Audi pieces. She was maybe 4 or 5, blonde hair with ringlets and a nice dress. She seemed terribly traumatized and completely resigned to her fate, and then I woke up. Now, I would like to say these kinds of dreams are rare, but they come around quite often, usually when I get stressed or depressed. I hate that in dreams sometimes you do things you would never do in real life. Like I would never leave my sister somewhere if she couldn't go with me. I know dreams are supposed to be messages from your subconscious, but sometimes I wonder if they indicate other things. I probably freaked you out with these two dreams, but I thought you might find them interesting. Please don't think I'm a freak for them. If I had the choice, I wouldn't have them at all. And thanks for your time. Hope I haven't traumatized you. No, not at all. And again, as I pointed out earlier, I think that it is indeed that subconscious communicating with you. This is why guys like Carl Jung and others began to look at the symbolic nature and what he called archetypes, the notion that there were these holdovers that are something that are deeply rooted within our consciousness and our unconscious mind, and how it relates to the culmination of experience over the course of time that is and has come to be humanity. And a lot of people would say, well, you know, I mean, if we're here, we're just here. I mean, why do there have to be these kind of things? Well, you know, think about things like instincts. You see animals like a badger or a wolverine that knows how to take food, carry it up a mountain to beyond the frost line, you know, and to where in the high mountain regions there's snow, and they'll bury food and they'll come back down the mountain so that in the cold weather months when food is more scarce in the areas that are normally more fruitful in the warmer weather months, they know that they can go back to mountaintops and retrieve food that they have placed in cold areas. Of course, what does this do? Well, this preserves the food because it's cold. Now, has a wolverine taught himself how to do this? Does it know, well, let's see, if I refrigerate my food, it will be preserved, and so I'm going to go all the way back up there, come down here, eat and, you know, and keep myself fat and happy in the summer months, and then when it gets to be cold weather, I'll just go back up there since it's cold down here anyway and I can't find any food. I'll go back up to the top of the mountain and pick up the morsels that I buried there. Sounds like a good idea. I think I'll try it. No, of course he doesn't put together this, as far as we know, this thought process behind what he's doing. These animals instinctively are able to do these sorts of things because it is conducive to their survival. And I think that humans, by virtue of being what we identify as conscious thinking creatures, the lines may be between what is instinctive and what is portrayed as a result of active thought. The lines between those two elements become rather blurry at times. And so in our rational mind, we have a very hard time, I think, reconciling with things that seem to be nonsensical. I've often said I work a lot of nonsense into this program, and maybe I'll address that a little later in the show. And there's a reason why, you know, because first of all, I enjoy humor. But by the same token, I think that there are things in our world that seem absurd. And our rational mind looks at these kinds of things, whether they be dreams, whether they be apparent occurrences that seem to fall outside the possible. And many of us respond to those kind of things by saying, nope, And there it is. It's all done because the rational mind can't reconcile with those things. But I think on a level that preceded rationality and the emergence of consciousness in humankind, there was a way of thinking. There was an operation that occurred. The instinctive level of human unawareness, I suppose, that carried us since time immemorial. And that's the thing, is that I think the holdovers of that sometimes trouble us. But in looking at them, we learn some interesting things. So we're going to look at that a little more deeply in the next hour. Consciousness, Mysticism, and Inner Arts here on the Graylian Report. You, as always, I'm Micah Hanks, and as we're coasting into the second hour, we're going to take things to a slightly more introspective area where we'll examine consciousness, other dimensions, how this relates to alien life, and also what we might call metaphysical interpretations of reality. It's been a path, so to speak, that I've been on for quite some time personally, one that I know interests many out there, and it's sort of an ongoing discussion on this program especially. One big reason being the fact that the more scientific we become and the more our mindful approach to solving the great riddles of existence becomes scientifically oriented, I do think that there is a movement away at times from asking fundamental philosophical questions. That is something that is both concerning and interesting to me, and therefore I think that from time to time we do have to kind of revert to the inner paths to outer space, as we're going to do a little bit during this hour. I want to remind you, if you're not a subscriber yet, you might want to check out Graylian X. It's easy to sign up. Just head over to graylianreport.com/X, where we've been addressing a number of interesting subjects lately, including on the latest Graylian Enigmas, we looked at the singularity, which is an interesting thing to look at in the context of a program like Enigmas, but I think it was a sci-fi take, since we, of course, utilize a more theatrical approach with that program, and yet nonetheless one that was quite meaningful. So do check that out. But on that subject of things which are meaningful, it's been a personal journey for me for a long time, and sometimes, I think like a lot of us, I get stuck in my head. I begin thinking about reality. I begin asking questions about, well, what is reality? Are we really who we think we are? I mean, is everything that we perceive in the everyday really what it appears to be? How do we really know these things? And I think that, again, within a certain degree of reasonable certainty, we can quantify the existential nature of what we perceive, and we can define that as reality. But there are times where I think there is a breakdown that occurs. And we don't have to get really far out there. We don't have to start talking about alternate dimensions, altered states, aliens, all these kind of things, just to recognize the little hiccups that occur in the everyday. Let me give you a simple example. that I think many of us can relate to. And I've certainly experienced this a good bit myself. You may be a person who has certain interests, and you may be a person who has certain beliefs and certain values, but yours will never match absolutely perfectly with another person. Maybe in very rare instances you will find somebody who, I mean, you just absolutely resonate with. It's as though it is, quote-unquote, meant to be. But often you'll find that simple misunderstandings occur in the everyday world based on things that are so subversive to our everyday examination of reality. They have everything to do with language, body language, culture. There are so many things. The clothes you wear. In other words, you are defined somewhat by the way you present yourself, and people interpret the outward expressions that supposedly represent you as actually being you. How can that person truly know you, however? And that's something I've struggled with a good bit, in truth. And I suspect I'm by no means the only person who has. I think many of us struggle to be understood, because by virtue of finding people who truly understand us, I think that we might equate that with love in one of its many forms. But I don't want to get all C.S. Lewis here and try and examine the different forms of love and what constitutes true friendship and true camaraderie and understanding or romantic love. But I think that is something fundamentally that we're all seeking. And therefore, when we have these hiccups, as I referred to them, these breakdowns in which, wow, somehow the person I try to present to the world is misunderstood. You know, I'll be sitting there talking with somebody and they'll ask me, for instance, what do you do? And this often happens. I've said it before at Nitrograss shows, for instance. The band and I will be performing, and after the show, someone will say, so what else do you do? Are you a full-time musician? You do this music, your passion, isn't it? They see the person jumping up and down on stage, waving his arms and strumming the guitar and singing, and this is, in their scope of reality, this is Micah Hanks. And I tell them I'm a writer, and they say, oh, right, yeah, are you going to write a book one day? And I said, well, I've written five. And I've actually had people say, oh, come on. Oh, yeah, am I going to get a straight answer out of you? And I'm not offended by it. I'm so used to it. But it is interesting that no matter how direct you try to present yourself, there are always going to be moments where someone just can't fathom who you really are. Especially if you're a really deep person. Think about clothing as well. I was talking with my good friend Laura Gardner the other day about, I look at the way that people dress. I remember the acoustic guitarist Tony Rice said some time ago, you know, you go to Walmart, you see how people dress, but they're slobs. And he was asked this because as a bluegrass guitarist, generally you don't associate, you know, Italian suits, Italian boots, you know, pocket scarves and silk ties with what bluegrass musicians would wear. And this is pretty much the standard dress for Tony Rice anytime he performed. And he said, I believe that, especially if you're a performer, you know, you should present yourself well. You know, have some class. And most people are void of class anymore. And it's not to say that certain fashion trends don't look good and that there aren't different circumstances where they are appropriate or inappropriate, but I do think that I recognize fundamentally that the clothing you wear outwardly sort of defines who you are. It becomes a part of the expression of yourself that others perceive as being you. And it, although it would be difficult to do, especially according to many cultural standards in parts of the Western world, it'd be interesting to see how the world would be different if we all ran around naked. In the sense that, without the color, you know, without the flamboyance that clothing provides, you know, think about that. How would we express ourselves? Would we have to rely on things such as just our natural beauty or lack thereof, which in itself is just as much a facade as the clothing that we wear? If we were all blind, or if we were all trapped together in a dark room and all we had was a telephone receiver to communicate with different people, think about the friendships you would form with people only with whom you could communicate via a telephone. And just imagine if all you had to go on was the sound of a person's voice and the kinds of things that came up in the conversations you shared with those individuals. Imagine if your scope of reality and the friendships that you made were based entirely on interactions like that. Anyway, I'm just giving a few examples, and absurd though they may be in a lot of ways, the broader point that I'm trying to address and bring home here is that a lot of what we think we perceive in the everyday and accept as solid reality, a lot of them are constructs. They're artificial, and they aren't necessarily bad, but we should remind ourselves sometimes the artificial nature of reality around us. And that's a good way, I think, to lead into the conversation as it relates to dreams and the idea of altered states of reality and maybe even physical dimensions beyond our own. Because one of the ancient questions mystics have asked is, well, is the dream reality as real as reality, the waking world? Many would say no, and especially our scientists of today, they say no. You know, your mind does things while you're sleeping that are absolutely removed from the physical reality. But I sometimes question, as many philosophers do, Elliot Wolfson among them, is that really true? Again, without question, I think that is our objective reality, but that doesn't necessarily remove the influence, and perhaps even more, that we might equate with the dream world, the world that we experience while we're sleeping. So I address some of these concepts, these philosophical concepts, these questions about, you know, the epistemological understanding of what we call reality. In other words, how do we know what we think we know? And I bring them up in advance of some conversations I've had over the years, and a few of which I want to revisit, as well as some general commentary from thinkers in the various fields, ranging from everything from altered states and hallucinogens just to mysticism and spirituality. I had one fascinating conversation with an individual, and it took place many, many years ago. His name was Slavik Vojtovic, and he was one of four contributors to a book called Inner Paths to Outer Space that Rick Strassman, MD, also had co-authored. Strassman, of course, being the author of the book DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And that really kind of became a landmark book in relation to, is reality that we perceive around us really the reality that is? And during Strassman's research with regard to DMT, for those who aren't familiar with it, most in the audience I'm sure are, but if you're not, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is a powerful hallucinogen. It is produced in the body, chemically similar to a number of things, including serotonin, and of course is capable of inducing a very vivid hallucinatory experience when administered, and it can be administered in a variety of ways. And back in the 1990s, Rick Strassman carried out a DEA-approved study in which DMT was administered to people in a controlled laboratory setting, and many of them described extremely strange experiences during an ecstatic state, a hallucinatory state. Many described encountering beings. And there was a book I wrote a number of years ago called Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, The Search for Sentient Intelligences from Other Worlds. And I used that title so as to make a very clear distinction that we don't necessarily have to go out there looking for physical, biological, alien life to question whether there might be other intelligences beyond our own. When my friend Laura and I were talking the other day during a hike, and the very next day, Susan Davidson, who I mention often on this program, she and I had a very similar discussion in which we talked about, again, the idea that there could be levels of reality, and whether there might be, to an extent, a capacity for inhabitants in those levels of reality. Is it possible to meet on a spiritual plane intelligences that are not human per se, universal, interdimensional, whatever you might call them? Now, this just—I know a lot of people would probably roll their eyes when they hear this kind of thing. But when we look at, for instance, the research of Dr. Jim Tucker, I know Jim Harold's interviewed him on the Paranormal Report. I'd like to talk to Jim sometime fairly soon as well. He doesn't, you know, involve himself in hallucinatory experiences or anything like that. He is a family counselor and a psychologist, but his primary area of focus is past life remembrances, especially children who claim to remember past lives. And many claim that they remember having some sort of a traumatic experience that led to death, and then some even describe remembering leaving the body and falling through a hole into a new birth, or waking into a consciousness in which they are in a new body in a new time. I mean, some people's claims of past lives are remarkable, and Jim Tucker has documented, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of more than 2,400 of them. I've even got a browser window open here with a paper that he wrote. And this was titled, Children Who Claim to Remember Previous Lives, Cases with Written Records Made Before the Previous Personality Was Identified, co-authored with Dr. Jürgen Kiel. But Jim B. Tucker, he's with the Division of Personality Studies at the University of Virginia Health System in Charlottesville. And it's just remarkable stuff. But I bring that up in the context of all this because if we suppose that a spirit, or what we quantify as being a soul, can leave the body, What if there are instances where we can have experiences where we meet other intelligences that are bodiless in that same sense? That's where some of this goes. So I caught up with Slavik Vojtovich a number of years ago, and we talked about this at length. And I'm going to excerpt some of that discussion here as it relates to the idea of mysticism, you know, looking at the world around us, trying to figure out the reality, the right of it all. And also how that relates to experiences that people have that seem to be beyond what we might call entirely physical.
We live in infinite universe, and I believe that there's an infinite number of alien beings who live in that universe. Some of them actually are not that alien. Some people imply that there are actually humans living on other planets as well, that we're just one of the lost branches of humanity. And so in a way, you can say that whatever we invent must, or whatever we draw, whatever we create as artists, must exist somewhere in the universe anyway. Or perhaps we actually create other realities just by the fact of creating artwork. That's another sometimes scary possibility, considering how much horror art has been created.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're tapping into some realms or some realities, and somehow, you know, my suspicion is those realities do exist somewhere. My understanding is that people experience all kinds of entities. Some of them are spiritual. Some of them match descriptions of aliens that people have seen on Earth, presumably, without any exposure to exogenic DMT. And this was actually a very interesting discussion between us authors of the book. We're trying to figure out whether those experiences are real or not. You know, people who claim that they've been abducted by aliens, have they been really abducted by aliens in this reality, or was it an illusion? Perhaps this was a spontaneous DMT release that caused that kind of experiences. And in favor of the latter hypothesis, you know, volunteers who participated in Rick Strassman's experiment, some of them experienced abduction-like experiences. And clearly, their bodies were on the bed in a hospital room where he was administering DMT and, you know, doing blood tests and collecting all kinds of samples, measuring blood pressure and so on. And yet they claim that they were abducted, that aliens probed them with different devices and stuff like that. The question is, how do you explain that? And, you know, during some of the book signings, which I did with Edith Fredska, we discussed that issue, and you know, we differ somewhat in our opinions of what is the reality of those experiences. My sense is that, you know, first of all, if you look at the mystical worldview, there is no reality except God itself. So everything else is, in a sense, a dream that God dreams, and there is nothing real. There are movies such as Matrix that explore that idea, or even better movie, which you may be familiar with, called Existence. Mm. That basically shows different levels of reality, and you know, there is a character or hero of the story that goes from one level of reality to another, but there isn't really one level that's more real than others. So let's say the dreams that we experience at night, you know, when we dream them, they appear to be completely real to us, and we're so immersed in them that we can't tell that they're just dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us learn to do something called lucid dreaming, when you're aware that you're dreaming, and then you can control your dream somewhat. And mystics, again, tell us that our reality, our consensus reality, is such a dream. And until we experience a glimpse of awakening, we firmly believe that this is the reality and the only reality. And especially when it comes to Western science, you know, this is it. This is basically it. There is nothing else.
Right.
And experiments and research such as the one conducted by Rick implies something very different. It really implies that there are multiple realities. I don't think that anyone looked at this from statistical point of view, since unfortunately there wasn't really more research conducted, especially in recent times, into those experiences. So I would argue that Rick's experiments were probably the only rigorously performed experiments looking at DMT when you have actually a sense of what percentage of volunteers have those kinds of experiences. You know, the experiences which I describe in my chapter are actually taken from an Arrowhead website that lists hundreds of experiences, both spiritual and alien and all kinds of strange things that people experience while using magic mushrooms. And since those molecules, DMT and psilocybin and some of the others are very similar from chemical point of view, it's not surprising that you would experience similar things with using those molecules. They work on the same receptors or very similar receptors, so it may be a matter of a dose. You know, they're probably somewhat different, and you can argue that different entheogens or hallucinogens, whatever you want to call those agents, open different gates in our minds. After we were done with the book, I was still had a nagging question, you know, was it real that people described as abduction experiences? And so I went back and tried to do a little more research, and trying to figure out, is there evidence that we have been visited by physical beings throughout our history? And when you put all this information together from rock paintings, you know, paintings in Africa, which date about 6,000 to 8,000 years, paintings in Utah, which are a little later because they are dated about 1,500 years ago or so, similar paintings in Europe, in Australia, variety of places across the globe. If you look at the art from medieval times, there are really amazing wood prints showing a whole bunch of objects in the sky. If you look at crop circles, which actually all these records of that are probably from 1600s, you know, you really start wondering. And then you read abduction experiences, descriptions of people who have been abducted in modern times. In my mind, when you pull all this evidence together, it's a pretty compelling. It's pretty compelling that we have been and are visited by a variety of alien beings. Now, some people can argue that this is all happening in our minds, and Ede is actually in more of that mindset. And, you know, we don't really have hard evidence in a sense of, you know, hardware or spaceships left somewhere unless there is something in the hands of our governments, which obviously we don't have a way to verify that. You know, and if you look at recent literature, there's a lot of stuff, lots of stuff written about not only abduction experiences, but people channeling alien stories. And if you look at the descriptions of what shamans experience during their journeys into spiritual realms, you know, you have a wide spectrum of contact, not only with alien entities, but spirits of all kinds, animal spirits, plant spirits, deceased people, people from the future. It really, you know, our perception of the world is very limited. We really live in this sliver of time, you know, moving from the past into the future. But apparently, if you go deep inside, whether we're using psychedelics or using meditation or trance induced by dance or other methods, you find that there's a realm, timeless realm, outside of time, where you can really access any information that you want. And that's what spiritual work and spiritual angle of our book is also about. You know, psychedelics are one of many tools which have been utilized by people over millennia to reach into those deeper realms. And those realms are not outside of us, they are inside of us. And the inside, the deeper you go, eventually you find it connects with the outside. You know, so from mystical point of view, or if you look at this at Christian or Jewish mysticism, you know, if you look deep inside, you find God. Mm-hmm. And Christian gospels talk about, you know, people seeking, and then if you seek, you'll find. If you keep knocking, the doors will open. They don't say explicitly, what are you seeking for? What are you looking for? And what door do you have to knock on? One of the Gnostic gospels, I believe it's the gospel of Philip, is very explicit in this respect. It says, you are the door. Knock on yourself. You know, again, if you look, we put a short or relatively short list of spiritual technologies which are available, and it's actually amazing how many things can be done to achieve this state of trance. You know, Jesus, for example, went fasting for 40 days and nights. That was part of the traditional Native American journey, that, you know, they would go into a deserted place and fast for many days. You know, people go into trance by dancing, ecstatic dancing. You know, there's just, it's amazing. Human creativity is really amazing. How can you really reach those altered states of consciousness using so many different methods?
I recall going into this conversation with Swavik years ago, interested in altered states, hallucinations that people have had, and yes, to an extent, also the similarities between the experiences of those who are what we might call psychonauts. That's a term that's been used for it at times in the past. And then, of course, those who claim that they have a physical interaction with some intelligent being unlike ourselves, i.e. an alien, and, you know, alien abductions and things along these lines. I went into this discussion with a sincere interest in those kinds of elements, and I found that throughout the conversation, the mystical elements kept coming up, which was very revelatory for me, and I think it just underscores the nature of mysticism. Later in the discussion, you'll hear Slavik comment more on mysticism and the role that the mystic plays, and in truth, how difficult it is actually to define what mysticism is. In a lot of ways, we can understand concepts a little better by those who embody it than the concept itself, but we're going to seek to understand a bit of that when we return here on the Graylian Report with a few more excerpts, perspectives, and ideas on the nature of finding oneself through exploration of the stars. It is the Graylian Report. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. When exploring notions outside ourselves, it's my personal belief that we're granted an opportunity to get to know ourselves a little better. And of course, through knowing ourselves more truly, we're able to bridge those gaps that lie between us. Hence, we can reach out and we have stronger, greater relations with others in the world around us. And so tonight we're exploring some of these deeper inner mysteries and how they relate to the world beyond ourselves, and perhaps beyond the reality that we think we know so well. And sometimes I think these kinds of conversations remind me of the fact that it's important maybe to revisit this kind of a notion more often, to consider the unseen world around us. That discussion I had with Slavik many years ago was indeed very intriguing. I've revisited it many times over the years, and we've done that again tonight to some degree. But there are other areas worthy of exploration as it relates to all this. I'd like to visit David Bohm's thoughts about the way that our theory of the universe reflects directly upon and even influences reality to an extent. There was an interview done with him a number of years ago, I believe 1989, at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, in which he was asked about this specifically. And as we talk about the nature of reality, what we see, what we perceive, what we know, the variety of experiences and interpretations of reality and some of those things that get a little more esoteric, I wanted to visit this segment where David Bohm discusses reality and the way that scientific theory can influence and relate to it.
You just said that in reality we make it all up, not just the parts, but also the wholes. Could you explain?
I think that's the question. What is the relationship of theory to reality, you see? Now, one view is that it reflects reality, you see. Now, that I think that it corresponds to reality. I think that view is only limited, right? Like a map is said to correspond to a city, but there's nothing on the map that corresponds to anything in the city. In the map, you see dots of print, and the city, which is very vaguely defined, the city is also vaguely defined. So what corresponds is certain abstractions that we abstract. Right? But the map, the real test of the map is that it guides us correctly in the city. And if it's a wrong map, we will find incoherence in our action. Right? Now,
but it's not that you can compare this bit of the map with this bit of the city.
Well, only in a rough sense, but that's an abstraction. You can compare it, but it's abstract. Right? Now, you see, so therefore we make it all up, but the question is how coherent is it when we try to make it work? You see, that's really the key. Some theories are more coherent than others, but it's often hard to tell because when we come to a theory as broad as a worldview, we find it very hard to detect incoherence because the worldview tends to state that things that don't fit are irrelevant, or else says they're going to we're going to get them in order later. We haven't solved that problem yet. So incoherence can easily be not noticed. But if people are very, and also people would like not to have their worldviews questioned because they have got used to them and feel comfortable with them. So therefore, it's very hard to question a worldview.
But in effect, that's what you are doing.
Yeah.
And in effect, you are questioning the whole Western worldview.
Yes, well, yes, I think even all the worldviews need to be questioned, the Eastern and the Western. See, the West has, in a sense, implicitly questioned the Eastern worldview. Every worldview, I think, is limited. But I think the Western worldview, its limits have not been seen. And we need to go to a broader view, not necessarily back to the Eastern, though it may include some of the Eastern. But I think we need a kind of dialogue of these worldviews to go to something beyond, right?
Something beyond, he says. And that, I think, is disturbing for a lot of people, especially of the Western mind, the notion that there is something beyond what is apparently physical and all around us. That's something that's even troubling for a lot of people. Now, if you're not familiar with David Bohm, he's brought up an awful lot, especially in relation to the idea that there is some sort of a breakdown between reality, mind, physicality, all these kinds of things. And please forgive me reading Wikipedia, but in the interest of time, I'd like to try and encapsulate his work, and I think this will be quite effective for the moment. Now, he had, of course, during his lifetime, advanced the view that quantum physics meant the old Cartesian model of reality, that there are two kinds of substance, the mental and the physical, that somehow interact, was too limited. And so to complement it, therefore, Bohm presented a mathematical and physical theory, being a scientist, but in equal measure, I should point out, also very much a philosopher whose contributions to everything from science and physics to neuropsychology should all be taken into serious consideration. But again, in response to this, what he felt was a limited perception of the connection between the mental and the physical, he developed a mathematical and physical theory of what he called implicate and explicate order. Returning to Wikipedia, he also believed that the working of the brain at the cellular level obeyed the mathematics of some quantum effects and postulated that thought was distributed and non-localized in the way that quantum entities do not readily fit into our conventional model of space and time. Now, Bohm warned of the dangers of what he felt were rampant reason and technology, advocating instead the need for genuine supportive dialogue, which he claimed could broaden and unify conflicting and troublesome divisions in the social world. In this, his epistemology mirrored his ontological viewpoint, but of course now, we should point out, as they do here in the article, he had, in his youth, been tied to communist affiliations, and therefore he had been targeted during the McCarthy era and had to leave the United States. He continued to pursue his scientific career in several countries after that. But his returning to his work, his main concern had been with understanding the nature of reality in general and of consciousness in particular as a coherent whole, which according to Bohm is never static or complete, but which is an unending process of movement and unfoldment. Very deep concepts, indeed, which is, again, why I bring his perspectives into this conversation. Here in a moment, I want to return to the discussion with Slavik Vojtovich, and we may go in different directions as time allows here later. But, again, as one begins to look at the nature of reality, and even as Bohm said, which may at times appear unrelated to some of the themes that were being addressed in the earlier part of the discussion before the break, especially those which seem to relate to perceived experiences such as alien abduction and contact with beings on some non-physical plane. Again, Bohm might have looked at these kinds of things as being whatever the modality through which the information was being received, an actual contact or something stemming from within the brain. These are perhaps elements indicative of the nature of reality, which perhaps transcend, again, the Western viewpoint toward the nature of reality. They are not necessarily excluded from other worldviews, and yet we have kind of pigeonholed ourselves, especially in the West, into a way of thinking which is such that we don't allow for possibilities because our empirical ability to reason, or rather our ability to reason based on empirical data before us, trumps all else. When in fact, I don't know that we are really to a point where that is a justifiable worldview to have. And rather obviously, David Bohm seemed to feel the same way. We do need to broaden, as he said at the very end of that segment before, We need to broaden our worldview and take into account different interpretations on a philosophical level and even a spiritual level of reality so as to perhaps bring a completeness to thought, which perhaps we have excluded ourselves from by becoming, as he had been concerned about, by becoming, I guess, rampant with our reason and technology. That's not to say that science and scientific inquiry and scientific methodology are bad. I think they're very good. But fundamentally, we also have to ask ourselves, at what point through our perceived understanding of the nature of reality do we approach the unintentional exclusion where we actually exocommunicate ourselves from reality to an extent by virtue of limiting our scope of what it may be? And so I've often found myself in a way of thinking in which I kind of try to gravitate toward the mystical path. And that's not to say that there's some magic necessarily that weaves everything together, although arguably you could look at it that way. But rather the mystic, the person who examines reality as best as we can comprehend it around us and asks, where do things not fit in? Like we were discussing at the outset of this hour, you know, why is there a breakdown in communication? Obviously, things aren't perfect. We have to strive for more in order to just to understand one another, and truly understanding ourselves is the beginning of all that. And so when I was speaking with Slavik Vojtovich, I asked him about mysticism, and he had some very insightful perspectives on that, which we'll revisit here and now.
I'm sure that you have seen Matrix.
Yes.
Right? The movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think it's easier to discover a mystic than mysticism. A mystic, in my mind, is a person that realizes that there is something wrong with our world, kind of like Neo mm-hmm. in Matrix. And he starts searching, and he will not rest until he will find an answer, or the answer, the truth, mm-hmm. the truth with capital T.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the goal of mysticism, to discover the truth. And it has to be an experiential discovery. It's not enough to read about it. It's not enough to know about it, you know, from hearing this from somebody else. It's something that has to be experienced personally, the truth. I can tell you what the truth is. The truth is that each of us is God. But it's meaningless unless you actually experience that. And it's possible to experience that. And meditation and other spiritual techniques lead to that. So in my mind, mysticism is something that outgrows religions. You know, each of the religions has roots and seeds of that mysticism within. You know, if you look, for example, at Judaism, you know, they have 75 substitute names for God. But if you read carefully the Old Testament, when Moses encountered God in a burning bush, he asked God, "What is your name?" And God actually told him his name. And God's name is I am.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you can see why this is a blasphemy in Judaism to say that name aloud. Because if you say I am, in the same way, using exactly the same expression, you're saying that you are God.
Right.
And that's when Jesus was in front of Sanhedrin, and, you know, they basically asked him, is it true that you are the Son of God? He said, I am.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, here's a blasphemy. We don't need any other proof. This is it.
Right.
You know, I think it was in Nazareth, when this is Gospel of John, I think Gospel of John 10, 24 or 34, I don't remember offhand exactly. But again, he's being accosted and, you know, Jews want to stone him for claiming that he's Son of God. And he says, well, which of my miracles do you want to stone me for? And they say, no, we want to stone you because you're claiming that you are God. And he says, doesn't your law say that you are all gods?
Mm.
Look it up.
That's
we
right.
are all gods. You can actually argue that God created this world because he didn't want to be alone. That's another thing that has to be experienced, and that's a metaphysical terror of experiencing ultimate loneliness. God being all-powerful and completely, completely alone. I mean, that's the worst terror, worst thing that you can experience. I think this is why some people who use psychedelics without preparation, without a guide, you know, without a shaman, jump through the windows.
Mm-hmm.
When you experience that, you may actually do that because it's such a terrifying experience.
Right.
it's part of the truth. Yes, you are God, but there is nothing that exists. This is the ultimate truth. You are the only thing that exists. You're not really the person who you think you are. You just are. And, you know, that's part of the deal. The God needs this universe, this reality, so that there will be others. And he created this world not to have zillions of worshippers who are going to fall on the face and worship him, but for each of us to become God.
At such moments, I often will advise people to try and look at this, maybe even allegorically, because there's a greater degree of instruction that can occur when one chooses to do this, in the sense that out of creation, I think whether or not you equate there being an intelligent God with all of it, and personally, I do feel that there is a creative force in the universe, and I word it differently from that to make the distinction between the kind of archaic notion of an old man sitting on a cloud throwing lightning bolts down. You know, we're not talking about a dude sitting up there. I mean, we are talking about a creative force, and perhaps something that transcends what we would recognize as being intelligence. But obviously, there has to be some sort of an impetus, some creative force, for all existence to come to be. And while I think that many in the scientific community would argue against that, I don't really see much of a distinction between the idea of creation and all that is versus the notion that all just is and all is without there having to be a God. Listen to what Slavik said there, for instance. You know, who you think you are does not exist. You just are. And that's a great way to summarize the universe. What perhaps we think the universe is not. The universe just is. It may sound like psychobabble to you. I'm sure that some people would just roll their eyes and say, okay, whatever. But challenge yourself to think deeply about this. Because again, the finite structure of the universe, what is, what was, what will be, we oriented ourselves unintentionally. We've evolved to orient ourselves, I should say, in a chronological way of seeing things so that we perceive the past, the present, and the future. We have evolved, and as my friend Susan often says during our conversations, there must be an importance behind that for us to perceive reality in that way. What Sir Stephen Hawking points out as being the thermodynamic arrow of time, and of course our intelligent interrelationship with it, in the way that we can remember the past, perceive the present, but the future, of course, remains imperceptible. And yet, within the context of the idea of a block universe, all already exists. Which brings, of course, to mind interesting notions like fate and predetermination that we won't get into right now, but it is very difficult for us, with our limited scope of all things must have a beginning and an end, to perceive the impossibility that becomes inseparable from the infinite. And our universe is very much that. Everything that we perceive that it is may not be, it just is. And here we are in the midst of it, and hence the allegory of ultimate loneliness, which is something that in metaphysical writings, you know, since time immemorial, ancient Christian writers, psychonauts, experiencers, and of course even those who have claimed to have gone beyond in the context of having had encounters with what they perceive as non-human intelligences, many of us have recounted over the centuries that concept of profound loneliness, which when one begins on the path, and I know this on a very personal note to be very true, taking the so-called path, which is opening your heart and your mind to question and attempting to perceive, as I do on a very daily basis, what exists beyond the periphery of the obvious around us, you do open yourself to an extent to loneliness and to misunderstanding, which is truly the most horrifying thing that many recount having experienced. And hence the allegory of a God, a creator that creates in order to combat the loneliness. It brings us a profound appreciation that we can come to find for the nature of reality, existence, and of course what we share with one another. Our time here is drawing fairly nigh. When we come back from this break, we'll wrap things up on this week's edition of the Graylian Report as we look within, try and understand ourselves a little better, and how that relates to the nature of the universe. I'm Micah Hanks, always glad to be here with you and having such conversations here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back to the program. In our final segment of tonight's broadcast of the Graylian Report, as always, I'm grateful that you've been here to join me on one of our forays into the questions that few are willing to ask either anyone else or themselves often. As we wrap things up here, for some reason, nonsense comes to mind. You'll notice when you listen to this program that since the outset of any given show, things tend to begin with a much more lighthearted attitude, and then we descend sometimes into darkness before picking things up a little bit right there at the end. I like the juxtaposition of absurdity with the very, very deeply introspective and serious, and that's something that I try to balance very carefully on this program. There are a lot of people, I think, who listen to the first 20 minutes of any given Graylian Report podcast, and they say, yeah, this is not a serious show. This is nothing that is worth your time if you're a real deep thinker. You give it enough time, and I think that those who stick around and listen find that we try to address extremely deep subjects, whether that be what we did last week with regard to the Georgia Guidestones and Dr. Mike Bennett. Got a lot of compliments on that, by the way. Or, as we've looked at this week, the fundamental nature of reality itself and questions maybe that we should be asking about it. Synchronicity is something that comes to mind an awful lot, and we've talked about that in recent weeks on the show. And it's funny because the more I begin to talk about it, the more I begin to realize the synchronicities happening around me. And the other day, I put up a post at my website, MicahHanks.com. If you go over there and you click the link at the top of the page to the blog, you'll be able to see this article I did. Look for the blue rose, which I didn't know I was looking for at the time I wrote the article. And the piece was inspired by a simple question I had. Do we really have to look for there being more to the nature of reality for it to be defined for us as being mystical, mysterious, and beautiful? Do we have to actually have strange things, for instance, the kinds of things we might discuss on this show, in order to justify the majestic beauty of the universe? Many would say that you don't, and really, I think in a more, I guess, Spartan sense, I kind of feel that same way. We don't necessarily have to gravitate to the extremely strange in order to appreciate and recognize the mystery that happens and unfolds all around us every day. And in writing this article, I got really personal and even talked about, you know, experiences I've had, you know, with love and with, you know, relationships with others, one girl in particular. I feel sometimes it's necessary to bare your soul like that so as to to positively convey the message and to do so appropriately. And in this piece at the end, as I was kind of wrapping things up, I wanted an image that I could associate with the article. I wanted to put some sort of an image. I always include images with the blogs that I put up. And for some reason, a rose came to mind. I don't know necessarily what the inspiration, although I think maybe after the fact, they always say hindsight's 20/20, and in psychological terms, you'd call this the hindsight bias, but I kind of thought maybe Rose came to mind. Maybe the name of Rose Tyler, a character from Doctor Who. And hence the blue was TARDIS blue, and blue, you know, blue rose came to mind. Boom, there it is. I don't know. Whatever it was, a blue rose came to mind. And so I went looking for an image that I could use of a royalty-free image of a blue rose. And as I began to think about that, I also stopped to consider, well, you know, of course, more so perhaps than any other flower, roses are by virtue of the color of any given rose, they convey a particular meaning or are meant to be used in such a fashion. And I was unfamiliar with the meaning of the blue rose, so I looked that up, and interestingly, here I'd written this probing analysis of how do we relate to one another? What is it really all about? And do we really need mysteries in order to look at the world as being majestic and beautiful and all this? And the significance of the blue rose is such that because they don't occur naturally in nature, a blue rose is meant to signify mystery, perhaps the impossible, and those who seek it. And it is believed, according to some customs, that he who holds the blue rose will be more capable of or destined to find that which he seeks. Which I found to be a very strange little nightcap at the end of the article. And I was talking with my friend Laura about this the other day during a hike we were on. And I said, that to me was very synchronistic. Nobody else may even look at it and assign any meaning to that. They may just think, well, you're just, you know, pulling straws. But to me, that I would write this long post and that I even note that at the end of the blog, the way that the blue rose just came to mind as if out of nowhere, and then suddenly, boom, here's this symbolic significance attached to it. And somebody who looked at the way that synchronicities may be evidences of those things which exist beyond was Terence McKenna, truly a deep thinker, ethnobotanist, and of course also an experiencer, a user, a practitioner of hallucinogenic seeking, and also a person who wrote and spoke prolifically on these subjects. And I wanted to visit a brief segment of a discussion with Terence McKenna in which he addresses the synchronicities and the coincidences as being evidential of those things which exist beyond.
Perhaps by sharing our experiences, we can begin to satisfy ourselves that the domain we journey to and from is not merely mental. And the way in which we confirm for ourselves that it is not merely mental is in the observation of disturbances in this world that we call coincidental or synchronistic or something like that. Now, this is elusive, anecdotal kind of stuff, but nevertheless, there's enough of it that I think there is something there. What do I mean? What am I talking about? Well, as an example, I have lived 42 years. Only twice in my life have packages of matches burst into flame in my pocket. In each case, it was about 4 or 5 minutes before I turned somebody on to DMT. Yes, an interesting coincidence, a totally non sequitur sort of thing, but twice in my life, packages of matches have burst into flames in my pockets. Many people who experiment with mushrooms report, it's almost achieved anecdotal status now, the scurryings and rustlings on the periphery. And when you do mushrooms fairly frequently, you get with this to the point where you just say, oh, that's the rats in the walls, the scratcher from hyperspace, whatever it is, because it's, you can't wrap your mind around it, but it's always there. And then less easily confirmed and communicated, but I'm sure we all have had this experience, is you will take a voyage into another dimension, be completely laid out on the floor for a long, long time, and then sit up. And at the moment that you sit up, the fire flares up, the logs fall through the grate, the coals burst into flame. In other words, there is a wave of regenerative activity that sweeps through the whole system. And people report playing with clouds. People report that after intense experiences, their lives are haunted by synchronicity. We ourselves dabble with this, that this belief that the world is entirely independent of our minds and objective and unaware of us is the kind of scientific fiction in which we operate. And then the real truth that appears to our perceptions, the truth of our immediate experience, is that the mind is a concentric field of diminishing intensity that can draw events and circumstances far from the ranges of probability. Once I had the following experience. It's all anecdotal, you see. I was in a dry wash in the Negev desert, and there was absolutely no food, and I was a poor traveling hippie, a hashashin, and a cave dweller, and a ne'er-do-well, and it was like 120 degrees outside my cave, and I was sitting in front of my cave, smoking hash. And out through the shimmering heat, I could see this dot of a person and as I watched them making their way through the rocks and the scrub, I began to have a fantasy about this person, that they had food, that they didn't simply have food, that they had Oysters Rockefeller packed in ice, that they had Russian caviar, that they had Belgian chocolate, that they had all of this stuff. And, you know, I hadn't had a bath in 3 weeks. There was barely any water in this place. And this speck made its way toward me, getting larger and larger. And finally, it turned into this guy I barely knew, a fellow lost soul. This was in southern Israel 25 years ago. And he came up to me and he said, I have oysters packed in ice. I have Belgian chocolate. And he had gotten a job dishwashing that morning at the King David Hotel and had just quit in disgust halfway through the day and had raided this super fancy 4-star hotel and just had a backpack full of this stuff. And I didn't even bother to tell him. I mean, what am I going to say, you know? I mean, sure, of course.
Those kinds of experiences are indeed strange. I think a lot of us have had them. And I think that many, including Dr. Kirby Surprise, have argued that synchronicities are really what you perceive of them. In other words, they're spotted by those who experience them. But is there something more? I can't help but wonder that myself sometimes. They're just too stark at times to ignore. That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. Thank you for joining me on a foray into mystery, as we always do here on the Graylian Report. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Caleb Hanks, Jeremy London, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Matt Oakley, Raisin Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next time, as always, stay strange. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylianreport.com.